crime professional investigator Justin Yentes. Here, we cut through the noise, dig deep, and uncover what others overlook. If you're ready to roll up your sleeves and get to the bottom of the story, you've come to the right place. Welcome to Truth Be Found. Let's get to work. This episode centers on a group rarely given the microphone in criminal justice conversations, the children and families left behind when a crime shatters a household. When one parent dies and another is incarcerated, the child becomes collateral damage, absorbing loss, stigma, instability, and trauma largely out of public view. Through Thaddeus Mellon's lived experience and Doug Passon's work in mitigation, we want to examine how trauma, context, and rehabilitation intersect with justice, and what society owes to the children who grow up inside of the system through no fault of their own. To address our story, I want to welcome our guests. Thaddeus Mellon is Rebecca Mellon's son. We're going to talk about who Rebecca is, and he joins us to share his experience as a child who lost both parents at once, one to death and the other to long-term incarceration, and what it means to grow up inside the system that followed. Doug Passon is a repeat guest and an attorney who specializes in mitigation and criminal defense work, helping courts understand defendants as whole people shaped by trauma, context, and capacity for change. To have this conversation, I wanted to give everyone a background of what this case is all about. So on a July night in 2012, tension filled the Mellon home in Phoenix, Arizona. Rebecca Mellon was in the house while her husband, Donald, paced nearby, threatening her as he had for months. Talk of staging a break-in, of hiring someone to kill her, and ongoing abuse. The day before, he had handed her a pistol and mocked her ability to defend herself. Terrified and desperate, Rebecca picked up the gun and fired. Donald collapsed, and Rebecca later told police that she blacked out for nearly 20 minutes and had no memory of pulling the trigger. When she came to, she called 911 in distress. Surveillance cameras captured the shooting and the moments that followed. What happened that night did not occur in isolation. Rebecca's life had been marked by long-term trauma. Raised in a strict religious home, she endured emotional abuse from her mother and was blamed for being assaulted by a youth pastor at age 14. She was later removed from her home, cycled through group homes, and became pregnant at age 17. As an adult, she entered a series of abusive relationships involving violence, threats, and weapons. Donald initially appeared different, but his control quickly escalated. He isolated Rebecca, restricted her movement, sabotaged her employment, and subjected her to repeated physical and emotional abuse. Police reports documented assaults, threats of murder-suicide, and visible injuries witnessed by friends. Alcohol worsened the volatility, but the control never stopped. Rebecca's son, Thaddeus, was also affected. Years earlier, court records show he feared his stepdad and requested no contact, describing him as a dangerous alcoholic with access to weapons. His stepfather's death left behind a complicated mix of grief, relief, and unresolved trauma. So Thaddeus, I want to start by asking you what you remember most clearly about kind of the moment your life completely changed.
What I remember most clearly, more was like the day of aspect. I remember arriving in one of my friend's vehicles with one of my friends and his mother. It was really early, and I remember pulling up to my house and there being like yellow tape all around the house, and me really just confused on what's going on. There was a big forensics van, I believe is what it was called, or something like a homicide van, something like that. It looked like a big RV in front of the house, and a bunch of cop cars, and my front door was wide open. That's what I remember vividly from just pulling up, then proceeding to, I was told by my friend's mom to wait in the car. She got out of the car, and I instantly got out of the car. I think panicking, I can't remember if I like got out of the car and just ran up to what, I just remember getting out of the car and, just feeling kind of panicked. Now trying to recollect it, I don't know where I went after that. I just remember like ending up in the van or whatever forensics thing it is, the big truck looking thing. There was a little,
you were
like,
pretty
table.
Young at the time. You were only 12 years old.
Mm-hmm. And they like sat me down on this little table, and there's like some people and some police officers and whatnot. And they sat me down and essentially said, there's no easy way to say this, but your mother shot your father and he's dead, is what I kind of remember being said. And like everything kind of like feeling really wavy and like just super hard to grasp. Right. I remember them calling my adoptive mom, having my adoptive mom come pick me up. Or who was my adoptive mom at the time. So she wasn't my adoptive mom. She was my, how do you call them? She's like the caregiver guardian, of the time, the guardian. And that was the first person they called to come pick me up after telling me that. I don't even think I was able to get anything out of the house yet at that point. I can't remember when. They like had me come back and like basically pick a few things that I could get. Yeah, by that time, I guess someone had like broken into the house, hit the water, hit like the sink or something,
right,
and flooded the house. So like it was super weird going in there.
So at age 12, you'd have been in what, about second grade? That'd be about sixth or seventh grade.
So. I was at 12. I think I had just finished being in the fifth grade. Skipped fourth grade and went to fifth grade.
So tell me if you can remember, how did losing your mom and your stepdad at the same time kind of affect your sense of, you know, safety and belonging?
I know for the longest time, like just like the comments of like even just being in school and like people talk about, like people were just talking about their mom or their dad.
Right.
And it would like make me like feel some type of way. To be honest, like around that time, it just seemed like it was really, like, I don't want to say gray, but like that's kind of like how life felt. Like I would go to school, I'd come back, I'd like lay on my guardian's couch. I don't know if I'm supposed to say her name or not. I would lay on Dina's couch and I would remember just like sleeping a lot at first. I don't know if that was just the natural way for my body
to cope,
to go through like the days. I just remember darkness. I remember darkness. I remember being on the couch in the middle of the day and just it seeming so dark and gloomy.
Now, did you feel like the, you know, as your mom's case started progressing, because, you know, Donald was, you know, at that point deceased, you were estranged from your birth father at the time, and your mom was now locked up pending trial. Did you feel like the justice system had, you know, seen you or had you in mind, or did you kind of feel invisible to what else was going on?
At that current point, like if when we're referring to when I was in middle school, the fifth grade, I couldn't even grasp it. Like it was
probably too young to remember that much.
Being seen by the courts or anything, everything via court kind of just seemed like abysmal to me. I didn't really understand anything. I didn't understand what was going on. Anytime court was brought up or it was about anything pertaining to like the Mellon family and whatnot, I just had no idea what was going on.
And maybe this would be a better than question for Doug. You know, when we're preparing a case for sentencing and trying to explain the context of a crime and someone's story to a judge who's going to make a decision on sentencing, at what point do they consider the importance of the kids left behind, or do they ever, do you feel?
You know, it depends on the facts of the case. You know, before though, first of all, I just wanted to say thank you. Because I'm sorry that you've been, this is a hand that you were dealt that you did not ask for and you had no control over. And I'm curious because, you know, I know just the bare facts about the case, but we're 14 years past it now, or 12 years, what, 14 years. Point is, when Justin read the summary of the what happened in that case, it takes you back, it puts you in it. And I'm just wondering, like, what, how did you feel listening to Justin read about the case?
I feel like every time I hear it, I feel like I hear something I didn't hear the first time, or I feel like all the times that I have heard it, I just hear something that I just missed. I don't know if that's due to like a memory thing or everything via like my childhood in general. I feel like before 12, like if you guys were to give me like $1 million, like tell you something, like I struggle to even try to recollect anything that happened.
How did you feel physically? Like, did you notice anything happening in your body when you were listening to that story?
Yeah, I was pretty stirred up in the emotional sense. I don't know if it is an aspect of like maybe I don't think about it enough, or I don't know. Just maybe like maybe makes me recollect like what me and my mom were like day to day, like living like and what we were doing. And when you get to thinking about like the stuff that like it just seems like people never talk about, like just the day to day things that were normal for them, it's like it starts to just make me be confused all these years later, even now. Yeah. A lot of it I just don't understand why it was like normalized in the house, or
why what was normalized?
Well, I mean, in the aspect of just like how like I prefer to just call him DJ instead of like stepdad or anything like that, because I mean he is, but how like DJ just like act in the house and whatnot, and just like he was so on like public, unlike public and like in events, or like if we ever went anywhere, he was so like that guy that like everyone kind of seemed like they're like, yeah, this is like the guy we love, like this is the guy we like, like, and he would make it seem like that was like how he was 24/7, and then like you would get home and like, and I knew on the day to day that like he didn't like me for like who I was, and I could get specific. I just don't know like how specific I'm allowed to get, because he's like the vulgarity of things that like were normalized in the house. But like,
well, what type of things would he say to you?
Well, I just know like as much as he said he accepted me, and through all the things that like court document wise he set up, he treated me very differently than what like it's even like presented as, and it's super weird. It's just like, they always were drunk, and that was a big thing with him, was like their alcohol was their 24/7. So I can't necessarily say if it was just how they were when they were under the influence, or if it was just their normal, because from whenever they woke up, which whether it was 6, 7, 8 in the morning, whatever, it was a water bottle filled with vodka to just bottles. There was never not alcohol involved. So like his daily view of me, I couldn't really like understand if it was his natural view of me, or if it's just how he was when he was like that. But yeah, like he would call me like the hard ER baby. He would call me the N-word baby. He would always be screaming at my mom about how I'm not his, but he has to take care of me because I'm around. Or it would be small things. It'd be like I'm kind of here, so that's why like I'm getting taken care of, but like he doesn't want to be, like he would prefer to be somebody else. And I don't know if that was just because I was around, or if it was because I was my mom's son, or what, but yeah, like,
And I feel bad that we're making you relive, but this is part of the process to really just dig in and peel back the layers and sort of understand the facts. And I didn't mean to evade your question.
Oh no!
But every case is different. Every client is different. Every circumstance is different. And you know, a lawyer's job is, and we're not that good at this all the time, but to just sit and ask questions and listen. Right. really listen. And, you know, in the state system, I wouldn't have gotten the opportunity to sit with you because the, you know, probably the victims' rights laws and things like that would preclude even having contact, plus you were 12. So, you know, but helping me understand this situation helps me answer Justin's question better. But I'll give you the broad answer, which is lawyers often try to help the judge understand the collateral damage in a case. That when our clients get in trouble and they have children or people that depend on them and love them dearly, they're victims in the case in that sense too, very real victims. And most of the time, when a lawyer, a defense lawyer, brings that up in court, a judge, rightly or wrongly, will either think it or flat out say it, you should have thought of that before you did what you did. Mm-hmm. And a lot of judges take offense to defense lawyers bringing up kids, children, family members, because they think that, you know, that's a manipulation tactic. Again, why are you talking about your children? You're the one that has the consequence. You own the consequences of your crime. And this is on you, you know, because you did what you did. Not you, I'm looking at you. But, you know, and then really when we get in big trouble is when we bring the kids into the courtroom. I don't know, did you ever go to court for any of your mom's hearings?
Yeah, so yeah. I remember one specifically. I don't know if when I was younger they had me go to court.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe I had, but I don't remember.
Yeah, seems like it was just the sentencing.
Yeah, the sentencing was what I remember. I don't remember like anything else. I think I just remember like getting asked questions or something like by like my caseworker and stuff.
Right.
They would like ask me stuff sometimes. But I remember the court case and what is it? When I was, I don't even remember how old I was. I was like 15 or 16, right? Like, mm-hmm. So, yeah.
But to come full circle, so in a case like this, I think it's deeply relevant. And I think any good lawyer, and I'm sure, and I know that your mom had a great lawyer, Jennifer Wilmot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that this was part of the narrative because in the sense of you should have thought of this before you did what you did, you know, that cynical expression is, you know, your mother may very well have been quite clearly thinking about you when she did what she did, and an effort to find a solution to a terrible, terrible problem that she had no way out of, that she couldn't figure her, she didn't have the tools and the capacity to extract herself and extract you and save you from that abuse. And you know, the abuse against your mom, absolutely horrible. But I'm hearing at this table, the abuse, even the emotional abuse of you, absolutely horrible. And I don't know how a parent sits by and watches helplessly as someone inflicts that kind of abuse on a child. And so she might have reached a point where she just broke. And, you know, she very much had you and her love for you on her mind. At least that would be a story that I'd be interested in pursuing if this were, you know, my case. So that's a long answer to your short question. It can be relevant. You just have to dig for the facts and figure out the truth of your narrative. And if you present that truth very well and very credibly, you could do that, and you should do that as a defense lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know when this case was initially charged, you know, we had the potential of a life sentence for Rebecca. And so being able to narrow that down to 20 years became a calculated decision. And in our sentencing memorandum, we had significant attachments. One of the issues in this case was that there were interior surveillance cameras that were all around the house and in the backyard. And those captured some very horrific instances of abuse, some of which Thaddeus is in watching, you know, seeing his mom be beat, thrown in the pool, hit multiple times, and ultimately the the homicide was captured on camera. And so showing the judge the impact that, that Rebecca was living under, the, or the threat, the constant violence that she was living under was really important to be able to get the sentence that we ultimately did.
And I will say in my practice as an attorney, but my, you know, my specialty is at sentencing advocacy, nothing in sentencing makes sense except in the light of empathy. In other words, by the time you reach sentencing, you're guilty, you've accepted responsibility, you've committed a crime, and there must be a consequence. But the lawyer's job is to help the decision makers understand the context for which the crime occurred. And empathy is the key to that, because that's about putting yourself in the shoes of another and seeing the world through their eyes. And we're really bad at that in the criminal I don't even say the criminal justice system anymore. I'm kind of over the justice part. I just say the criminal system, because, you know, you can find justice in this system, but it's a lot. It's few and far between. But, you know, the point is there's an empathy gap, and there's a wall. There are walls put up where people don't see the humanity, and they don't want to understand. And in especially in a domestic violence situation, and I've had these types of cases, and the non-empathetic sort of just emotionally void responses. Well, she could have just left. Why did she even stay? And you know, I've literally heard prosecutors make that argument in a court, and it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the dynamic of domestic abuse and the control that a person has over another individual. So I'm going to need to tell that story in all of detail, and I'm probably going to need an expert to do it too, because we have trauma experts, we have domestic violence experts, and all these psychological experts that we have to employ to help put the clinical truth on the story truth. But can I just ask you, why do you think, looking back, I know you're young, but you're old now, and you're an old soul. Looking back, why didn't your mom just get you guys out of there? What was stopping her?
Well, sadly, it was definitely a multi-attempts thing. Oddly enough, we definitely left plenty of times. There's multiple instances in multiple states where she definitely left and tried to get away. I don't know if it's an aspect of knowledge mixed with funds, making the ability to get very far or get very far efficiently hard, but
well, and some aspects of it you might not be aware of.
Yeah,
because she had left and fled, and DJ was able to track her down through a family member
multiple times. I remember Nebraska specifically. I think we flew out there, me and her, we flew out there to her parents' house, and it wasn't long. It was like a matter of 48 hours that we were there, and she was there running from DJ because they had gotten into it, and he just beat her pretty bad. And it seems like every time she's been beat by him, it's not like it's ever like simple. Like, it's until you're like bubbly and the face type deal. That's just, I don't know if that's his like go-to. It's just like, it was always really extreme. Well, and it was never.
And these are things you saw with your own.
Yeah. So that was a thing, is like, we would leave that. We would get into a cab. We'd get to the airport. We'd get on a plane. We'd be three states over, and 48 hours would go by, and he's already contacted her mother and father. They've already told him where she is. Because the big thing with her support system, which isn't much of a support system, was her parents. My grandparents grew up with the aspect of everything's always been my mom's fault. So even if she's getting beat up and she's going through that situation, it's her fault, and she should face it head on. So they had told DJ where we were, and he arrived within like 48 hours of us getting there, at the door.
and proceeded to drag my mom out of the house. And I remember having to go with them. And it was right in front of her parents. So you figure, like, why no one would call the police, so on and so forth. But it was an aspect of her parents believing that that was how she needed to be treated, because she wasn't proper of a person for them. Like, she wasn't. It's always been this aspect with my grandparents for my mom that, like, she's just not much of a person is what it kind of seems like. Like, they don't treat her like a person. They treat her like, it's hard to explain, like, less than, for sure. Like, that's definitely how they've always been. But it, that wasn't the only time. Like, another time in Nebraska, she was at her sister's house, her sister Rachel. And DJ would show up there, and same thing would happen. When we lived in San Diego, she ran down the street, literally, at a point in time where I was just at the house. I was at the house by myself, but that was because DJ was there. She was there. He ended up beating the crap out of her, and then she ran. I want to call it, like, down the boulevard, but it was like, it was just on San Diego Strip, and she just ran down the houses and ended up banging on one of the houses. And I remember, like, this whole story being told from them, but, like, it was an aspect from him. It was an aspect of, oh, you ran away and you went to some guy's house. And I remember it being like him getting really mad at her, him beating the crap out of her, her running, getting to some guy's house. And then I have no idea how, but he got her back quickly. Like, it was really confusing. And I remember her begging when she came back for him to let her go, like, repeatedly, like, no, DJ, please let me go.
Yeah.
And
were you aware of the locks on the house?
I remember not really being able to leave ever.
And the interior surveillance cameras?
I remember knowing there was cameras, but not, like, in the aspect of understanding what was going on with that. Like, I thought it was, like, when I was a kid, I think I used to think that, like, the police would watch us through that.
Right.
Like, so it was kind of like a, everything I seen was what was allowed. Even when we would, my parents used to take me to, like, bars with them.
Yeah.
And, like, I'd be in, like, cabs alone, and I'd be in, like, hotel rooms alone and stuff. And, like,
I remember interviewing bartenders who would remember your folks getting,
I was just like, getting, like, cranberry juice at the bar.
Sit there and color.
I get cranberry juice on ice. And, like, right. I always remember that. Mm. But, like, those were, like, that's what would be considered, like, positive memories. Or, like,
Sitting at the bar
with some cranberry juice. And yeah. And I just remember, like, plenty of times at, like, bars where, like, I remember vividly we were downtown Phoenix one time, and I remember him, like, elbowing my mom in the nose, and her nose just gushing blood, and him just calling a cab, and the cab just, like, take her home. I'm like, take her back. Like, and these cab drivers, always, it didn't matter. And I know he knew. So, like, he always had, like, specific cab drivers and specific people he worked with. Because, like, big tipper, whatever. He was really acquainted with everybody. Whatever it was needed, or it was a car repair, it was dental work. It was my mom, even to this day, she's like, can you reach out to this dentist? Because he said I have free dental for life. And I was like, in my brain, I was like, it was probably because DJ was either giving him enough money yearly or enough money in general to just, like, whenever you guys go, did not matter. And now when I'm going to hit him up about it, he's going to be like, you're nuts.
Well, I think it's...
I got a question. I'm sorry to interrupt
no,
you.
No, go ahead.
You know, when you bring this up, where there are all these other sort of culpable players in this story.
24/7.
People who... Yeah. Turn the other way.
Tattoo artists.
Didn't help.
Bartenders.
Didn't step in. Didn't stand up for you, for your mom. So I was kind of wondering, where were the cops in all this? And if there are all these instances of prior violence, are the police involved? You know, the county attorney seemed really excited to rush in and charge your client
right.
with this ridiculous amount of time. Were they ever around when this man was doing what he was doing to her?
They were ordered to go to court-mandated counseling, and we were able to get some of the records on that. And what I found interesting, and I don't know if you ever knew of, is some of the homework that they were given in this court-mandated counseling was for DJ to let your mom go to the store by herself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That was an assignment that they had one week. And that one always stuck with me, because the amount of control that your mom was living under was so great that she couldn't even go shopping for groceries by herself without having court intervening counselors guiding her husband to let her do that.
I couldn't tell you ever when my mom would go to the store by herself. But I couldn't really tell you when my mom ever was by herself. I remember my mom getting in trouble for having the door closed and being in the bathroom. I remember my mom being in trouble for being in a room that she's not supposed to be in. Like,
right.
A house is a house, but it's not always like a home in the aspect of, like, he definitely made it seem like, even like as a child, like it definitely had a sense of, like, now as I'm older, if I think back to it, like it definitely felt like, I don't want to just say a prison, but like it felt like a box with locks in it for sure. Like, right. It felt like it felt like his goal was to provide everything that we could want or need inside the house, and then basically make it so you don't go anywhere. And then if you did go anywhere, I always remember it was an aspect of like showing off my mom till she wasn't show offable, or like it was more of like my mom was like an object, in the aspect of like he took her where he wants, he did what he wants with her, and when he was done with her, he just sends her away. Like, mm-hmm. That's it. Like, it wasn't like they were partners, they were married, etc. It was like, it was like this leash situation. It was like, she was controlled, but like in ways that like you just wouldn't expect. Like you feel like you'd tell her when she could breathe type deal. Like,
so it sounds like the police probably weren't as involved as they could have been. Sounds like that's pretty toothless counseling.
Yeah.
I'm guessing there was competing narratives throughout this of, you know, the defense narrative of a horribly abusive, you know, spouse. Was the state's narrative a gold digging, manipulative, whatever, right. You know, kind of deal? Because this guy clearly had two fronts. He had the public facing front where everyone thought he was the greatest guy in the world, 100%. And the private truth. And my guess is there were a lot of people that came forward and were horrified by this and said, how could something like this happen to such a wonderful, caring, generous, right, human being who took these people off the street, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a thing?
That was definitely the narrative that we were up against.
Yeah.
It seemed like everybody too, that was like, even friends of my parents and like even people that like spoke on, like, I don't know if we call it podcasts, but like even TV shows and stuff like that, and even podcasts that I've even seen, it's just, it's crazy how they paint it and how they like paint just DJ in itself. Like, even during like I don't remember the specific like show, but mm-hmm. The one that like I remember like seeing when I was a teenager, I can't remember what the name of it was. I'm sure you might know what I'm talking about, but at like all of their friends and the kids, yeah, and all spoke on it, and just watching it like made me so sick, like hearing the stuff they were saying. It was like, what? Like, what? Like, where are you getting like any of this stuff? Like, even like DJ's ex-wife, and like the aspect of like saying like how perfect he was and how he never raised a hand to her and how he never raised his voice at her, and then finding out from internal family people that was never the case and that he was definitely doing those things. Right. But it was an aspect of like so many people defending this person that like you're just confused on why they're defending them. And then like it was always like that though my whole life. Like, when the police would show up, like they would get turned around. Like, it would be like, there's no issue here. It didn't matter if my mom was busted up and bloody. It didn't matter. Mm-hmm. The situation always switched to, she's a drunk and she doesn't have any control over herself is what he would tell them. And I got it handled. But like at the rate that people would just be like, okay, like it doesn't matter. Like as an adult, like I would totally figure everybody's just paid off at this point, but I have no idea what was going on. Like as a kid, it just seemed like it felt like the world was against my mom. Like actually though, like she seemed like she had nobody to turn to family, nobody to turn to friends. And every time she did, they would tell on her. And I don't know if they were getting rewarded for it, but like, that's what it seemed like. It seemed like her friends would sell her out. Her family would sell her out. Our family, our friends would sell us out. And then he would be back pulling her into a cab, sending her home. I can't even think about all the times that I've been stuffed into a cab with my mom.
What's definitely undeniable in this case is the amount of abuse that your mom suffered. Because, you know, in many of our cases, we have histories of abuse that we can't necessarily prove, or the proof is shaky or subjective to the teller. But in this, we had actual video of the surveillance cameras in the home of repeated incidents of abuse. I don't know if you've seen those ever.
I've seen some. I don't know like what all is. I have received some stuff like that, and just watching it was really hard. I'm not really able to like get through a lot of videos.
I don't doubt that.
It's weird. It's weird. A lot of the videos that like were affecting me differently were ones that I was in. Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember it. Like it was like so weird seeing yourself like in a video and not being able to recollect it. It's really weird. It's like just like how am I there?
Block that out due to the trauma.
Like I can't like remember it like at all. Like, and you're seeing it. And, like, I'm not moved. Like I remember seeing myself just standing there and like my mom would get like pulled by her hair in front of me and like hit and stuff, and like I'd just be standing there and like I'm sitting there as an adult looking at like what's wrong with me and what? I don't know what's going on in my brain.
You know, we've had a lot of cases, and by we I mean Justin and I, where our clients were you. In other words, as a young child, they went through so much trauma that it completely transformed their life in the worst way. But there's always almost always a common narrative to that story too, which is the people and the institutions that were charged with the responsibility of caring for, nurturing, protecting that child fell down at every opportunity. And, you know, hearing these horrible stories of abuse just leaves me wondering how were you helped after? I mean, who took care of you, either individuals or processes, systems? I know I heard you were in a group home for a while, but can you talk to that experience of what, who did anyone step up to make sure Thaddeus was going to be okay?
I mean, I know I was placed places. Like I was placed where I needed to be, apparently.
Tell me more about it. We're talking like foster homes.
Yeah.
Homes.
So when I was placed in the group home, I was 13 turning 14, something like that. I was 14. I was either 13 turning 14 or 14 turning 15. I remember being there like a month before my birthday. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what was going on. I kind of got put in a car and just kind of drove somewhere. Via the process of like what it was like in getting there. I mean, I was an only child for the majority of my life, other than when like DJ brought his kids around. So it was just kind of the first time being around like other kids and other guys and whatnot, and being in a like an 8-9 person household. But the group home that they specifically put me in was a high facility juvenile group home. So they and what my group my
what
case
do you mean high facility?
They all of the kids that go to that group home are for behavioral issues, and they're coming out of juvie and can't go back to their parents. So I was essentially told by my caseworker that I was placed there because of the expectation of me becoming problematic. So they kind of just put me in a problematic situation, and then I like just had to work through it. My life prior to the group home to through the group home is night and day. I used to like joke saying like I went from riches to rags, but like in a literal sense, like it was a big thing with the group home that I had to get my caseworkers involved a lot. I was really vocal, but a lot of the other kids weren't vocal because they were so used to it. But there was like there's a lot of times that they just didn't have food. Literally, like having ketchup and mustard in the fridge was like a rarity type deal. We wouldn't get like groceries like that in the aspect of we used to get what was called food drops, which was like a signed up deal to get expired food from like this. I remember the guy was like down the street and like he'd bring a big semi with pallets of like expired food, and like that's kind of like what we used to bring into the house, and that was what we always used to eat. I always remember we used to dig through it and like try to like when we're bringing it in progressively, and like there's a staff member, but they can only be so many places at once, so like we'd bring it in, we try and like find like the best things that are in the expired pile of food, but like you'd be looking at like if we ever got candy or anything, like you're looking at like a year and a half your old stuff that's just like it's odd that they have it, but it's cool that we got opportunities to have it.
Okay, well, my heart sank into my stomach when you said you went to a high facility with at-risk youth and a lot of people who already been through the system. So it leaves me wondering, how did you deal with those other kids, and what was the worst aspects of being in that element?
It was bad.
What did you learn from those other?
I learned a lot. I think it was more of like a reality check for me. I feel like the big thing was I got my butt kicked a lot. I got into a lot of fights that I didn't start, and I got my butt kicked a lot until I was able to fight back in my own essence, and I got into football, got into wrestling, etc. But like those kids are just mean and just big old kids. Some of them weren't even just 18. They had kids up to like 25. Which weren't kids, we're a full-blown adults, because they have the young adult program, which goes up to, I can't remember if it goes up to 21, and then the kids that were staying past 21, they were allowed to stay in the housing for free as long as they followed all the rules, etc., for however long they want. This is made for a lot of crazy things, stuff that I never would have gotten into as a kid. I ended up getting into being there. The kids were just bad, man. They were not like, it wasn't normal. A lot of them were like doing stuff just every day to get into it, or like the police were always there. We literally had one kid at a certain point in time threaten the president on Twitter and have I remember them just being black uniform Secret officers. Yeah. They were very, very deep. Like there were like eight trucks. They swarmed into the house. They had us all in the kitchen. They were like all, they went into his room, but it's because he was making like terrorist threats to the president. But like those are the kind of kids we had. Like they were just nuts. They were definitely not. Yeah. I definitely didn't consider myself on the level of them at all, but that was something that was kind of known by the different staff. Was I just tried to work my best to get cool with the staff, because it was like, if you're not cool with the staff, you're not going to be good. So they have this thing called independent time. Just essentially when they let you go off by yourself and go, whether you're going to a friend's house, you're going somewhere, whatever. Super strict. But in the aspect of no one ever had it, I had it a lot. It's really my only way out was to get approval. So I had to get approval from my caseworker and then the group home. Sometimes it was court approval too. It was just super, super lame. But I had to get approved to like just leave the house and like get out of there, which went along with my whole life's aspect of being with DJ and needing to get permission.
And
to
you did not nothing wrong. It's a thing. You're treated like a little criminal.
And then being in the group home, I can't remember how long it took, but I remember getting like my first phone call from my mom, which needed to be worked into more than likely, I'm assuming illegally, because I wasn't allowed access to speak to her on the phone. So there was something done where like they had to like put my, they had to fill out my information with someone else's information on the call.
So how, and let me ask you about that. How is the, how have you maintained a relationship with your mom and brought that to a point of healing as she's been locked up?
Even just from the start to now, even when in the group home, really when I got my first phone call from my mom, it was like, the world shattering. It was the first time I talked to her in forever, and it was just, I was just a young kid that just, I just missed my mom. Anytime I got on the phone with her, it was, that's all I could tell her. It's just, I miss you, I want to go home.
I know being away from you was extremely traumatic for her. We had a phone call where I was able to play a recording of you saying hi to her, and I remember her breaking down on that. And you know, the separation that she has felt from you, I know, has been probably the worst punishment of all.
Yeah, that's all she ever talks about is she just wants to be around me, and that's what sucks. It's like, My mom was never like a mean person. That's what.
No.
She was always at home with me, and the good memories were sitting on the couch watching cartoons with my mom. That was a majority of my childhood, but that was like what was cool, like for us, was like we'd sit down and like watch SpongeBob and Cartoon Network and stuff, and like she would just sit there with me, and it kind of always seemed like, while she was there, like while she was sitting there with me, it was like that was her mm-hmm. out too, like that was her getaway. And like he would kind of leave us alone, like we're sitting there in front of the TV, there's nothing to like mad about. But like any other time she was doing anything else, she was just always in trouble. Right. She wasn't allowed to do anything outside. She wasn't allowed to go outside. She went out in the backyard, she'd just get in trouble. Like
Well, I know that I'll tell you, every time that she and I have continued contact, you're first and foremost. And you know, being able to get back out and take care of you and be in touch with you has always been, you know, her goal in life at this point.
That's what we talk about every time. It's just when we get to get back with each other and just kick it. It's the first thing she wants to do when she gets out is she just wants to sit on the couch and watch some cartoons. So. Mm-hmm. She kills me when she talks about it, because like, I swear I don't cry a lot as an adult, but when it comes to my mom, she just kills me, because she just wants to spend time with me. She doesn't even want to do anything.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
I don't know yet. I just met you today, but you seem like a great human being and very like got your act together, and I'm just kind of wondering, because like I said earlier, we've seen so many cases where someone's so traumatized and so broken and so affected by the things that happened to them as a child that they grew up to do some pretty bad stuff, and that's not your story. And I'm wondering, what do you think went right in this whole tragedy that helped you become the you that you are?
I know from when it happened to just going through the group home, the big thing that was like the focus from like all the staff and my caseworker and like different counselors was essentially just like damage control, just try to point me in the right direction as much as possible so that I know not to do it. I think the big thing with the type of group home that I went to was I got to see everybody do stuff that I wouldn't want to do. I watch people get in trouble for the craziest things. I watch people, so many people get arrested. I watch people seize out and do drugs that I've never seen or heard of. And they were kids. I have plenty of, I could say now as of 25, most of the people that I knew from the group home are either deceased or in prison. I know two or three people out of the multitudes of groups of kids that are in and out constantly of the group home. Because that's the big thing. It's like, it was really the kids that lasted. It wasn't like it was kids that lasted. It was the kids that didn't get sent back to juvie. It was the kids that didn't overdose. It was...
Well, how did you avoid being one of those that ended up in prison?
I just thought everything was kind of crazy. As a teenager, some of the things that like I participated in that they did were like they like would go to the store and like they called it bottle runs and stuff. They'd steal a whole bunch of liquor from the store and they'd bring it in the window. And like I remember like being a teenager and like drinking, but like all the like crazy drugs and stuff that they'd bring in, like I never wanted to try it. Like it was like I would see the stuff that they would like be going through, like they'd go outside and they come back in and they would come in completely whacked out, and I'd just be like, that doesn't look fun. Like it doesn't, like they didn't look like they're having fun. Right. And in itself, a lot of the times they were giving something that they shouldn't have taken. Like a big thing that was normalized in the group home for a lot of those kids was they called it spice.
Yeah.
And as an adult, a lot of people just call it fake marijuana or fake weed. Right. Or whatever. But yeah, I seen a lot of kids doing a lot of like spice and stuff, and they would be really whacked out. Yeah. And that kind of like deterred me from trying stuff like that. I was just like, no.
Were there any like adults, mentors, coaches, teachers, friends of your mom's, anybody that stepped up and had a meaningful role in shaping you?
For my mom's, I mean, I had people that like helped out. Like my mom has, I don't even know what he's considered, a family member or something like that. But like, he's helped out with like my phone bill my whole life. Like he's still like the owner of my phone bill and like still pays my phone bill. And I don't have to worry about a phone bill, but like that's the kind of aspect. Like I had a phone because she worked out a deal with this guy to get me a phone bill. And I've always had a phone. And
so
that's kind of like it. Support systems from my mom's side.
Yeah,
my aunt, all of everybody, I'm like,
now
my
you're
family
able to
never...
reconnect with your birth father.
Yeah,
which has been great.
Yeah, but in the group home, I had ended up reconnecting with my dad, my birth father, and it ended up working out because I mean, from 12 on, I needed a dad. I had no dad. Even beforehand, I didn't know him. Like while my mom and my biological father were alive, I didn't know him. I met him physically. I think I was 17 when I physically met him the first time. So I mean, I'm doing as good as you can do for meeting your dad at 17. But I found out I have two half sisters when I was like 14 or 15 when I found that out. I had a lot of new knowledge when I was a teenager. But yeah, I just, via support systems from my mom, I could, less than a handful, I could tell you that, but I couldn't tell you anyone I could think of. No one really helped my mom. My mom always was a solo dolo when it came to things like that. She tried her best to get everything done herself. That's what kind of like led her into DJ was... She always tells me, even today, like nowadays, everything she did for me. And she always says that she just wanted to give me a better life than what she had. And she wanted to be able to provide. And he gave that ability to her. And the aspect of him having money and things like that, that's where a lot of people like brought into, oh, she's got to be a gold digger, all this and that. And I was like, what's hard about that in my mind is like, how are you a gold digger but going through all this stuff to get this? So, like, yes, you get this end result, which some people will call a reward, however you look at it. You got some sort of access to money is what I would call it.
because she wasn't able to do what she wanted at all with money. If she wanted to go to Circle K to get a Kit Kat bar, she couldn't, right. Which is the point is like, what having any kind of money or having any kind of comfortability at what cost is what she had to deal with. And to this day, I know that she only sat through all of that because she was trying to get me the best situation possible. And I've definitely been through some different mindsets where when I was a teenager, I thought everything happened because I went to my friend's house that night. And that was the hard thing when I was a teenager. I was always when I seen those videos of like him beating her up and I wasn't moving, that's where I would always get irritated, because like I remember certain times when I would like stand in between them and like try to get them to stop fighting and like stop like doing what is going on. And I think it was kind of just an aspect of like I wanted to be able to help my mom go through everything. I just didn't know how, and I was too young, and I was just a little kid. But I don't know, if you're talking number one support system, it was probably my mom's number one support system, just because I was literally all she had, and even to this day I'm still all she has. And that's what sucks is.
And that's exactly why in a case like this, the story of the drama inflicted on the child of a defendant is everything. She was only in that terrible situation to give her own child a better life.
Right.
The bitter irony of it is that she ended up losing her child and being separated from her child because of it. But that's the central narrative from, you know, the hour we spent at this table. It's absolutely so key. It's a perfect example of once you do this exercise and you really get to the heart of the matter, an attorney, if I'm the attorney in this case, I'm walking away with a crystal clear vision of what the very true, credible story is in this case, and that's it.
Exactly. We really appreciate that, Thaddeus. I know it's a difficult conversation to have, but I think it's valuable for you to always be able to talk through what you've lived and to understand the totality and the complexity that was your mom's case. And I know that that she's looking forward to, she's only got a couple, 5 or 6 more years left, and she's very much looking forward to being out and being with you again.
She just wants to be able to chill. She wants to just live a little. She doesn't even want too much. That's what sucks.
She just wants to be with you.
She just wants to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Yeah, I appreciate you guys for having me.
This episode challenges us to expand our definition of victims. Justice doesn't end at sentencing. It ripples through families, childhoods, and futures. Thaddeus' story reminds us that survival is not guaranteed, and Doug's work shows us that context matters if we want justice to mean more than punishment. Did this episode change how you view incarceration and who bears responsibility for children left behind after a crime? These are complex topics, and we want you to join the conversation. Share your thoughts, questions, and reactions on our social media channels. These stories matter, and so does what we do with them. Let's let the truth be our guide. We'll see you next time. Thank you for tuning in to Truth Be Found. The hunt for answers never stops, and neither do we. Don't forget to subscribe and follow us online to stay in the loop. Remember, truth has a way of coming to light. Until next time, keep your head up and your eyes sharp.